Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Kate Flannery, and I'm the Executive Director of Community Engagement at Syracuse University. I will be your moderator for today. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge with respect the Onondaga Nation, the fire keepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Thursday Morning Roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University's Office of Community Engagement. It features prominent newsmakers who discuss current events in Central New York and far beyond. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today, Professor Paula C. Johnson, Professor of Law at Syracuse University. Paula C. Johnson is Professor at Law at Syracuse University College of Law. Professor Johnson and Professor Janice McDonald co-founded and direct the Cold Case Justice Initiative, which investigates racially motivated murders committed during the civil rights era and in contemporary times. She is a member of the Franklin H. Williams Judicial Commission, which educates and advises decision makers throughout the New York court system on issues affecting both employees and litigants of color, which implements recommendations developed to address those issues. Professor Johnson has held several distinguished teaching posts, including the Haywood Burns Chair in Civil Rights at CUNY Law School, the Sparks Chair at the University of Alabama School of Law, and the Syracuse University College of Law Bon Shenikin King Distinguished Professorship. She has also taught at law schools at the University of Arizona, the University of Baltimore, and Northern Illinois University. She is a member of the Democratizing Knowledge Collective at Syracuse University and serves on the SU College of Law Committee on Inclusion Initiatives and the Onondaga County Bar Association's Diversity and Inclusion Committee. She has also served as co-president of the Society of Law Teachers from 2002 through 2003. Professor Johnson serves on a range of College of Law and University committees and is a faculty advisor to the Black Law Students Association and Outlaw, an LGBTQ organization. She is the recipient of numerous awards in civil rights and social justice and education, far too many to list this morning. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Professor Paula Johnson.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. Thank you all for joining us and having me at this hour of the morning. I'm not sure if this is everyone else's typical hour, but it's not always mine. So I am happy to be here with you and to discuss issues that we are currently engaged in our society and to draw connections to areas that I think are worthy of our attention, worthy of our knowledge and of our action. And so I've titled this talk, A Tale of Two Jacksons, Confirming a Justice and Remembering a Legacy, the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the United States Supreme Court and the civil rights legacy of Warlist and Exelina Jackson. And so here you have an image of Judge Jackson. And as I imagine many of you are doing, as am I, watching the confirmation hearings with rapt attention. I think it's important to note not only the historic nature of Judge Jackson's nomination, but also what she would bring to the US Supreme Court. And so as it has become clear, for those who weren't familiar with Judge Jackson before, she brings a wealth of experience to this nomination and to the position for which she has been nominated to the highest court of the United States. Indeed, her experiences in many respects exceeds those of her predecessors, in addition to members of the Supreme Court who currently sit on that body. She is currently the U.S. Judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District Circuit. She, prior to that, she was on the D.C. Circuit for the District of Columbia in a trial judge capacity. She has served as vice chair of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Her work as a public defender has been something that also brings unique qualities and qualifications to the court. She has served as a judicial clerk in every level of the federal bench, on the district court level, on the appellate level, and as a Supreme Court clerk. Indeed, she will be, she is slated to take the seat of the justice for whom she clerked, Justice Stephen Breyer. Now, last on this list, but certainly not least, is the fact that she will be the first Black woman nominated to the United States Supreme Court. And I think that this brings several important historical matters for us to recall. And that is about the position of Black women in the United States as an historical matter. Most, certainly not all, but the vast majority of Black women came to the United States in the position of enslavement. And that circumstance of slavery in the United States has characterized a great deal of the continuing experiences of racism, intersections of sexism, along with that, in the experiences of Black women in the United States. Indeed, what makes it so noteworthy, let's say, that just Judge Jackson will be nominated for this seat, is that there was a time in the United States when Black women had no recognition as autonomous or legal beings within the United States government or within US law. Black women were considered as chattel property. There were no injuries that could occur to Black women as their own beings, so that rape or sexual assault were things that were not violation to Black women themselves, but to those enslavers who claimed them as property. Moving from the period of Reconstruction after the emancipation of Black folks after the Civil War, there was still a very determined effort to gain total equality for formerly enslaved persons in the United States. Black women did not get all of those rights, even as we were some of the main activists and proponents of equality in the United States through the United States Constitution and other societal institutions and provisions. That meant, for instance, among the Reconstruction Amendments, the 15th Amendment conferred the right to vote on Black men who had previously been enslaved, but it did not confer the right to vote on Black women. Similarly, the 19th Amendment, which conferred the right to vote on white women, on women, was the only time at which Black women also were able to enjoy this fundamental right in the United States. But prior to that time, the suffragist movement was one that also was plagued with separatism, such that Black women's rights were not always recognized as a part of that movement. So we have been characterized for many of the omissions of our placement within this society. And it's one of the reasons why the fact that justice or judge, going in advance of the proceedings, but one of the reasons why Judge Jackson's nomination to this seat will have such significance for the position, recognizing the position of Black women in this society. Now, as Judge Jackson has said herself during these proceedings and in other times, she stands on the shoulders of others who preceded her. While she is the person in the position now to be nominated for this seat, she surely is not the first woman who would have been qualified to occupy this august position in the United States Supreme Court. And so here you see the late Judge Constance Baker Motley. She was the first Black woman to be nominated to the federal court. And she also had a very illustrious legal career with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, arguing cases and helping on many landmark cases, including Brown versus Board of Education. And as you see some of the images to the right, you see her being sworn in to her position. And also the image below, you see her with James Meredith. She represented James Meredith when he integrated the University of Mississippi in 1962. And so there are many women, such as Justice Motley, who could have been nominated for this position. And so here we are recognizing that Judge Jackson has these women as part of her legacy and stands on their records as she is set to assume this position. Now, again, the title of my discussion with you is A Tale of Two Jacksons. And so whilst the names of some of those shoulders are more well known, such as Thurgood Marshall or Constance Baker Motley, some of them are lesser known people, but no less momentous for the contributions that they have made to racial justice and equality and the values of the United States. And so we have people like Worlis Jackson Sr. From Natchez, Mississippi. Worlis Jackson Sr. was killed in February 1967. He's one of the over 100 cold cases that the Department of Justice and the FBI have listed as among those cases that were killings or murders that were committed for racially motivated bases. It's the work of the Cold Case Justice Initiative that we continue to investigate these cases to bring information and also accountability for those who were responsible for these killings. Mr. Jackson was a Korean War veteran. In the previous slide, you saw him and his wife, Exerlina, with their five children. So he was a father. He was also the treasurer of the local NAACP in Natchez. In 1967, at the age of 36, he accepted a position at the Armstrong Tire and Rubber Company, in which he was the first African-American to take a skilled position in that plant. He received numerous threats upon being offered and subsequently accepting that position. The Armstrong Rubber and Tire Plant, which was just adjacent to the residential Black community in Natchez, was also widely known to have workers there who were part of the Klan. And so it's widely believed that members of the Klan were responsible for his death. He was killed by having a bomb placed under his truck as he left work on Monday, February 27th. As it happened, he worked overtime that day. And so he actually left later than he otherwise would, which is to say that when the bomb was planned to go off, the streets of Natchez in the residential neighborhood would have been highly populated by children, by others, because it would have been earlier in the afternoon when his ordinary schedule would have had him get off of work. But as it was, he left work around 8 p.m. And so the streets were more isolated at that time. Nevertheless, when the bomb went off, it was a catastrophic event. It blew out windows. It caused great property damage. Most importantly, it ravaged Mr. Jackson's body and his vehicle. It was time to go off as he made a turn with his steering wheel. And at that point, the bomb simply blew him up. And so what you see here is the aftermath of the damage that the bomb had done. Now, you know, and you can see how it is in the middle of the neighborhood when this bomb went off. His son, Warless Jr., was 9 years old at the time, and he heard the bomb ran to the scene on his bicycle. And you can imagine how a child of that age would hop on a bicycle and, you know, ride through the backyards in order to get, you know, to that scene. Because as Warless has said, when he heard the blast, he knew instinctively that that was his father. And so he ran to the scene. So even as, you know, neighbors who had gathered there tried to shield him from the scene, he saw enough to have been traumatized by witnessing what happened when someone or persons killed his father. And so it remains a major trauma to him, as well as other members, his sister and other members of the family. And so in honoring two Jacksons, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and also Warless and Exerlina Jackson, for what they mean, what their commitments, what their sacrifices, what their contributions have meant to advancing the cause of equal justice, the promises that our Constitution has for equal justice for all, that we recognize with our Warless and Exerlina Jackson Legacy Project, those who have been less heralded, but who nevertheless have made signal contributions along these lines. They have served, they have given, and they have committed themselves to ensuring that all of us have the opportunities that they were unable to have in their own lifetimes, and that we make those promises real for others. And so, on April 1st and 2nd, the Cold Case Justice Initiative, along with the Warless and Exerlina Jackson family, will be hosting the Jackson Legacy Project. And in that project, we will have speakers from the family. We will have speakers on issues of, you know, voting rights and democratic participation. And significantly too, because Mr. Jackson and his wife, Exerlina, fought for voting rights, but they also fought to make sure that employment opportunities, that educational opportunities, that full participation in all of the institutions in US society were open without any barriers based on race or ethnicity or any other types of characteristics would be there for all people. We want to continue that legacy so that young people, you know, junior high school students who are dreaming and planning for their own futures will get information about how they can pursue those activities. So for instance, people who are interested in going to college or in pursuing vocational employment or creative or have creative aspirations will be able to talk to people in those fields who can say, this is what you need to do to prepare. How would you prepare for the SAT or the ACT, for instance? How would you get into vocational skills training, electricians or plumbers, or all of those kinds of skilled trades? This, after all, is how Mr. Jackson had his life taken, being the first in a skills trade in Natchez, Mississippi. Those who are interested in doing creative pursuits will be able to talk to people about how they pursued, those aspirations. And so we have put together a program for adults and for youth, for everyone to become aware of people like the Jacksons and the Jacksons themselves, and also to get information about how they can go about pursuing their own dreams, the dreams for which others gave their lives to make these things possible. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson has noted, for instance, that she was just the second generation in her family to go to college. While her husband was one of six generations to have attended Harvard. And so for many people in the Black community and other communities of color, we don't have that kind of longevity in going to institutions of higher education, much less going to law school or other graduate educational programs. And so we want to make sure that this is the legacy, that we continue to do the work as we celebrate and honor those who have made these paths forward possible for all of us in doing this legacy program. What you also see on this slide is that the PBS Frontline program did a documentary about the lives of Worlis Jackson and his wife, Exelina, called American Reckoning. And that was it was aired originally in February, but it is also now streaming on YouTube, so it is available to be seen. We're very pleased to know that the directors and producers of American Reckoning are going to be our keynote speakers at the Jackson Legacy Project. Brad Lichtenstein and Yoruba Richin will be speaking on Saturday, April 2nd at our program. They've done an excellent job. I will add that I was included as one of the persons interviewed in that documentary. They came to SU, they came to the law school, spoke to me, spoke to a number of our students who volunteer and work in the CCJI project. And so, CCJI is, featured in the documentary, but it is an important educational experience to watch this because it puts this legacy in perspective, and it puts the community's response to the death and the killing of Mr. Jackson in perspective as well. The community boycotted white businesses after Mr. Jackson's death because of the segregation, because of the discrimination that they experienced through the community. And it was, as it were, a last straw when they also killed Mr. Jackson. And so the documentary does, it has, quite, disturbing footage in some ways because it's very, transparent about what happened to Mr. Jackson, but it also tells this story, this narrative, you know, speaking not only to members of the Black community, but also to the descendants of Klan members and their awareness of what was going on, and in some cases, their lack of awareness of what was going on in their community. So it is told in a very fulsome way from various perspectives, so that this is the information that we rarely hear, but which we need to hear to get a comprehensive understanding of what has been taking place in our country, what kinds of issues we continue to grapple with, and how we might go forward to address these issues. And so with this, I leave it again at the present moment. And so here we see Judge Jackson with her family, her two daughters who are immediately to her left, her husband to her right. And I was very struck yesterday by hearing her comments, and I thought that was, you know, noteworthy too. And it was the note that I wanted to conclude on, because she's looking at the future, but she's also recalling what some of the challenges have been in her own life and those things that we continue to face even as we rise above them and go forward. And so she was asked about what would be her message to young people. And she said, "I appreciate the opportunity to speak to young people. I appreciate it very much. I do it a lot. I hope to inspire people to try to follow this path because I love this country, because I love the law, because I think it is important that we all invest in our future. And the young people are the future. And so I want them to know that they can do and be anything." She said to the committee about how a high school debate team visit to Harvard had led her to study at Harvard University, and about her rough experience when she had arrived there. She said, "I think the first semester I was really homesick. I was really questioning, do I belong here? Can I make it in this environment?" And as I was walking through the yard in the evening, and a Black woman I did not know was passing me on the sidewalk. And she looked at me, and I guess she knew how I was feeling. And she leaned over as we crossed and said, "Persevere." And I think that that is the word to end on. That would be why we're doing the Legacy Project program in honor of the Jacksons, Warless and Exerlina. And that is why we celebrate the work and going into the future, a future with Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson on the US Supreme Court. I will end it there and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Johnson. Persevere, it will stay with me today and hopefully ongoingly. Thank you for sharing that important topic. Some of the questions that have been posted, could you respond what your thoughts are on the position of adding additional justices to the Supreme Court that has been in the news and talked about to some degree? Would you share your opinion, please?
You know, I'm not really certain about whether that's a a non-starter in this climate. I don't know whether that is something that will, address the kinds of concerns that I think the proposal, seeks to address. And that is, what is the state of discourse within our political and judicial institutions in the United States at this point, where things are so riven with polarization that we seem to be unable to reach any kind of consensus on major issues. So I'm frankly not certain that adding more justices will really get to the heart of that matter. So I'm fairly agnostic on that issue, because I think in some ways it doesn't address the core concern, and that is that we must find ways forward in order to see that there are common issues, no matter where we are on the political spectrum, which are important to the nation and not just to certain sectors of the society.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you. Another question. There's been a lot said about the nomination regarding her previous experience with being a public defender. Do you see that? Can you share a little bit about that? Is that as a benefit or any thoughts you have about that?
Yeah. Thank you for the questions. I do think it's a benefit. I think it's a benefit because not since Justice Thurgood Marshall have we had anyone on the Supreme Court bench who has represented defendants in criminal cases. And he, of course, was the counsel, general counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And in that position, you know, even as someone who represented defendants in that capacity, the Legal Defense Fund was able to select the clients whom they would represent. I mean, there was great need, of course, but they could decide which cases they would represent and those whom they would not represent. You know, it may be a little known fact, for instance, that the NAACP did not immediately get involved in the Scottsboro boys case, those nine young Black men who were accused in Scottsboro, Alabama of rape, who were later to be exonerated of those claims. And so it was actually ACLU who began their representation of the Scottsboro young men. My point is that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund did a great deal of important work, and Justice Marshall represented death row inmates and a number of people who were accused of crimes. But he was able to be selective in terms of whom to represent. Public defenders cannot be selective in that way. Public defenders have to represent the people who come before them, and they are assigned those cases. And so in that respect, public defenders have the experiences of representing people across the broad spectrum of all kinds of accusations within the criminal justice system. Most of them are poor, or, you know, low-income poor people, and many of them are also people of color. And so it brings an appreciation for voices or perspectives that are not typically included in the deliberations or considerations that justices have at the highest level of judicial decision-making. So that will be a voice, a perspective, an experience, I think, that is important to hear people discuss. I would just say further that on this point, in her comments and in her memoirs, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has said how important it was to her awareness to have Justice Marshall in the room as they were considering cases, because she had not had the lived experience or the work experience that he had in the law or in American society. And so it benefits all members of the courts to have as many points of view in that room as possible. I like to take a line out of Hamilton to say, you know, to be in the room. You want to be in that room. We haven't been in that room in so many ways. And defense attorneys are included among those, you know, very important, you know, parts of our judicial system, our constitutional system that have not been typically included.
Thank you. Very enlightening, thank you. I have a question here. Would you comment on the veiled racist attacks on Judge Jackson in the hearings yesterday?
I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, Kate, if you said veiled or vile, but let me just say, I think they were both. Well, some not so veiled, frankly, but several of them very, very vile. Just absolutely, absolutely astonishing. And I will tell you that I have watched a number of Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Some of it is just by dint of my own, you know, my profession. Some of it is by dint of, you know, because I think it's a citizen's, you know, responsibility to be knowledgeable and aware. And I will say just in passing too, that I know Judge Jackson was born in Washington, D.C., I grew up in Washington, D.C. And so was very, very familiar with all of the, you know, political goings on in the nation's capital. I have never seen anything like that in my youth or in my adulthood or in my professional life. And I know that these hearings can be contentious. I've seen that, but I have never seen the kind of rancor and disrespect that I witnessed yesterday in particular, that felt like it felt assaultive to me as I was watching them. And this supposedly in the nation's highest deliberative body, a place where they are supposed to be decorum, where we are supposed to flesh out ideas in that so-called marketplace of ideas. And what I saw instead, now you mentioned defense attorneys, what I witnessed instead seemed as though someone was being assailed and charged in ways that I simply have not seen anyone else treated. You know that I teach. And so I had a class yesterday at 4 o'clock. And so I've been watching the hearings, you know, at my desk, you know, live on the computer, you know, like every moment, you know, that I can. And I had to wrest myself away from my desk to go to class. And I had witnessed all of these, you know, just these assaults on, you know, her reputation. You know, one of the senators, I can't remember, I think it was Hawley, who said, in effect, I don't believe you. I've never seen that before. I've never seen a senator say to a Supreme Court candidate that they did not believe something that they said. Now, they can hold whatever opinions they want, but I've never seen that to take place and be said on the record and to the person directly, you know. So in any event, I, you know, was in the throes of watching all of that. I had to go to class. You know, and I said to my class, you know, these are the things that are the reasons why it has been so challenging and dispiriting in many instances to try to enter the spaces where we are, Black women in professional capacities or any parts of this society. We saw that happen to somebody who was nominated for the highest position in the legal profession, being treated as though she were just someone off of the streets. And it was the most offensive thing I've ever witnessed, I must tell you truthfully. And it was outrageous. And it was beneath the dignity of the institution. It was beneath the dignity of all the people who were present and watching. And it is really my fervent hope that if there isn't rejection and repudiation of that kind of activity, then I really do fear for where we go from here in trying to meet out any of our obligations as a democratic society.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Another question here, Professor, in what ways are SU students able to get involved in activism surrounding the Jackson Legacy Project? Is it only open to students in the College of Law?
No, it's not. You know, all, it's primarily students in the College of Law, but it is open to other students who are interested. In fact, we have over the years and currently, we have students from other schools who are working with us. We have Maxwell students. We have had Newhouse students in the past, students who were in African American Studies, Department of Education. So, you know, School of Education. So there have been students from across the campus who have volunteered with us. And so they can simply express an interest, you know, let us know. We have the volunteers, and then we also have the seminar that is attached to CCGI. So that class yesterday that I was referring to was the CCGI seminar, which we have on Wednesdays. And so students are, you know, welcome to enroll in the seminar. And they also can, you know, work with us as volunteers. Law students, for instance, who volunteer can get, you know, pro bono hours that they need, you know, for their, you know, for their participation and graduation requirements. But they also could take the seminar for credit. So there are, you know, various ways, you know, so if you all, you know, are in other schools and colleges, are aware of students or would like your students to know that they can participate with us, please don't hesitate to let them know. They can be in touch. They can contact me directly. They can go to our website and just let us, you know, let us know of their interest.
Thank you. There's a question here about how you as a Black woman, as a citizen, stay as an educator, stay optimistic and hopeful in communicating your history, our potential future paths. And how do you mobilize that energy?
It's a tall order, let me just say. What I was saying to my students yesterday was, you know, I don't view what is going on in those hearings, you know, from a distance or with arm's length. When Judge Jackson was speaking about her experience in Harvard Yard, that resonated with me in a most direct way. And so when she came to the end of her statement and she said, persevere, I think I could hear the collective ahas from Black women across this country saying that they recognize that experience as well. Because I can't imagine that there were moments in that hearing when Judge Jackson may have wanted to just dispense with some of the niceties and be a little more frank than she was in her own defense. And she did stand up for herself quite well. But this is what we have to do in order to reach the goals that we aspire to for ourselves and for others. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of just saying, well, I'm just walking away from this, right? You know, many times in my own life and career, I have not felt as though it was just about my being able to say, you know, take this, you know, whatever, this job, this position, this whatever it is. Because I'm looking at other people who are coming up behind me, and I don't want them to give up their dreams. And I'm not saying that we put up with anything and everything. But I'm saying that there is a way to do the work so that you don't diminish yourself and that you make sure that people respect you in the process. And I talk about this to my students. As Jake read earlier, I am faculty advisor to BALSA and also to the Outlaw Group. And these are still, by and large, these are still young people, coming through law school. They're still in their 20s, most of them, some a little older. But they need to see that there are others who have been able to get to places that they're aspiring to reach in their own way. But they know that it can be done because others have done it and continue to do it. And that is how I mobilize people. I mobilize, I hope, through my own example. I mobilize by being supportive of the students. They know who I am. They know that I am accessible to them. I am as frank and honest with my own colleagues when there are issues that I think merit certain types of commentary and attention. And so it isn't that it's easy, right? Far from it. But there sometimes can be satisfaction in just being in the struggle. And so I like to remind myself that it is a struggle and I'm part of it in whatever capacity I can contribute. And as one of my friends, another law professor, has said to me as we talk about these sorts of issues, she said, one of the things that keeps me going is that I know that my ancestors had it far worse. And so when we remember those folks who didn't make it through the Middle Passage, those folks who endured enslavement and fought for their own freedom and for ours, I just feel as though I could do no less. And so in the words of Judge Jackson, I persevere.
Thank you. I think that's a perfect thing to end on. Thank you. I want to just mention that I can't thank you enough, Professor Johnson, for your sharing of your wisdom and your lived experience and your knowledge and inspiring all of us to persevere and to do better and to be the citizens and to create, to live and work for the values that we hold at the highest esteem. So thank you. I also want to thank the audience today for joining us. Thank you for sharing your valuable time with us. I will hope that you will join us next Thursday when we will hear from J. Cole Smith, the Dean of College of Engineering and Computer Science. Please know that our presentations are recorded and available for viewing at the Office of Community Engagement video channel page. The forums are also recorded through a partnership with WCNY Radio, and the audio versions can be found on WCNY's Thursday Morning Roundtable webpage. I want to thank you all so much for your time today. Go forth, have a good day, and thanks again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.